My next guest is well known, really, to the Maine community. This is Pat Callahan, who started working at WCSH 6 News Center in December 1979. He is the co-anchor of the 5 p.m., 6 p.m., and 11 p.m. shows and has been co-anchoring the 6 p.m. newscast with Cindy Williams for 27 years. Wow, you've been around a long time.
Wow, indeed, yeah.
Yeah.
Time flies when you're having fun.
Well, it does seem like you've had some fun. I can't imagine spending as much time as you have doing what you're doing if you didn't enjoy it in some way.
Oh, no. One of the great things about it is sometimes it's not like working for a living. A lot of times it is. There's always a routine that you get into, things that have to be done at a certain time. But it's usually something different every day. So while you follow the same pattern or routine, there's something else going on that, and you think you've seen it all, and you never have.
Now, you grew up not in Maine. You grew up in Framingham outside Boston.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me a little bit about that early path. Did you know from the moment you jumped out of the womb that this is what you wanted to do?
I didn't know, but it's not surprising that I would have been interested. My dad worked for a radio and television station, first in Western Massachusetts, then in Washington, and then in Boston. And that's when I came along. And it was always something that seemed like an interesting way to make a living to me. And the other part of it was that we had three or four daily newspapers in the house. So when you're a kid, you start out reading the newspaper and you read the comics. And then you read the sports pages. And then eventually you start reading the rest of the paper as well. And in those days in particular, when you had morning and evening editions of papers and a lot of competing papers in a city like Boston, plus the local Framingham paper, you got a lot of different opinions and takes on things. So it teaches you to be a little open-minded about ideas and figure out, you know, who's right and who isn't. So I was always interested in the news, and we would watch the newscast. My dad was anchoring sports for a while. At the time when the Red Sox were having their impossible dream almost 50 years ago now in 1967. And that was very exciting for a kid who was about 11 years old. That's just the right time. Watching him do that was pretty interesting. And occasionally we'd go into the station with him. At the time they were located in Kenmore Square in Boston, not just two blocks away from Fenway Park. So if we'd go to a ball game, we might have to stop by the station for something. And seeing all the technology stuff and also, they had kids' shows in those days. Major Mud was one of them. And they had this science fiction thing called Fantasmic Features, when the host was a guy named Feep. And when you saw the big Feep head on a stand, it's like, ooh, I know that. Anyway, so it always seemed kind of glamorous and interesting. And in college, I went to the University of New Hampshire and worked for the radio station there, mostly as a disc jockey. And I loved that because you can play what you want when it's college radio and really express yourself. But I also started doing news. I didn't really study broadcasting as such or communications. I studied English and history. So I've always thought that is a good background for anybody in this line of work because you know a little bit about a lot of things. And it teaches you how to ask questions and how to seek out information and research things. The TV part of it or the radio part, the broadcasting, that's easier to learn than the rest of it. You have to be able to write quickly on deadline and have it come out making sense without laboring over it sometimes. So it's a good background for that. Just to conclude that story, which went on forever, when I graduated, I had several part-time jobs. One was writing for the nightly newscast they used to do at New Hampshire Public Television, which was almost like going to grad school, which I considered doing. But now I'm with people who are out reporting the news in a place where there's a lot of interesting stuff going on because of politics, which I've always loved. So I got to follow the governor's race that year, and it was really interesting to see how it's done and you know, just the whole mechanics of it all. And occasionally they'd let me get on the air to fill in or something, and that was it. I was able to put together a tape with some demonstration stuff. And when I was looking for a full-time job, I wound up in Bangor at WLBZ. I had applied here in Portland, and they said, well, you're not quite ready for this yet, but we've got another station, and we think you could use some seasoning up there. And they were absolutely right. So that's where it began.
And from what I understand, Bill Green helped you out for a little bit of a time when you were in Bangor.
He did. Bill was working at LBZ then. He's a Bangor native, so he really knew his way around. He's very friendly, very open. He didn't really know me at all. And the first day I was there, he said, hey, you know, if you need to use my apartment to make phone calls for looking for a place to live. No, so Bill, you know, is the oldest friend I have in Maine, and it's a pleasure that that we're still working together after all this time. And you have this sort of shared heritage, if you will, that we've seen a lot of things come and go over the years, and we'll make jokes about something that some of the younger people have no idea what we're talking about, and just a couple of old fools. But you know, it's been very nice. And the other great thing, Don Carrigan worked at WLBZ at the time too. And I remember when I first walked in, I saw this reporter. He had a full beard at the time, which I thought was unusual for a television station. I think the reason he had it was he was appearing in a play. He was probably doing Fiddler on the Roof or something, because Don does a lot of community theater and still does. But you quickly learn this is a guy who knows his way around, and you can learn a lot from him, and I have, and I still feel like I'm learning from him now. But in those days, I was hired to produce and anchor the 11 o'clock newscast, as well as report. I covered City Hall, all the city council meetings and so forth. So you had to learn how to do a lot of things. We were shooting 16-millimeter film back then, and there was no computers or word processors. Everything was done on typewriters, and you had to type your scripts with carbon paper, so you had multiple copies. And to put the newscast together, you have to assemble a big film reel with each clip of film that you're going to use and make sure they're in the right order. And if you have to drop something for time reasons, you can't just throw the tape aside or anything. You've got to now spool through that piece of film. It seems outrageous. You wonder how you got it done, but you do. And all of it was all part of a great learning experience, because you're involved in every aspect of producing and reporting.
So do you think that there's something that has that's missing now, that people don't have to go through this whole process, or does it not really?
No, there's a different kind of multitasking they have to do now. There's a lot more reporters in our shop and others too who have to work on their own, what they call multimedia journalists or multi-skilled journalists. They always come up with some, you know, thing you can initialize, but really what it means is that they shoot and write and edit all of their own stuff. In some cases, that can be good. I've always thought it's better to have two people do work on a story together, because you have someone to bounce ideas off of, especially when you're starting out. You know, it's nice to have somebody who sort of knows their way around. In Bangor, for example, it was really helpful. The head photographer there is a guy named Paul Salisbury, a good friend of mine who just passed away a few months ago. But he was from Southwest Harbor area, you know. And so he really spoke the language, and I didn't. You know, I would have looked silly or sounded like someone who didn't know what in the world he was talking about to go down there and talk to people if you got to do a story on some fishing thing. And to have somebody who really knows it and knows how to break the ice and get people feeling comfortable was incredibly valuable.
Having done this for as many years as you have, I'm guessing that you have a fair sense of what's going on in the state, and you have a fair number of contacts.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly in the political world, I've covered a lot of these people for a long time. I've covered five governors and six U.S. senators over the years, which doesn't seem like a lot, but the people in Maine, in the Senate in particular, tend to stick around a while. It's been, you know, and I know many of the legislators. I don't get to the state house as much as I used to, which I always really enjoyed. I like the vibe up there. But I know a lot of those people. And I like to think maybe the more valuable thing is not just the contacts, but the people know who you are, and they have a sense that they can trust you to treat them fairly and get the story right. And if you screw something up, you'll tell them and apologize and move on. That's what I like to think, that because we have people like myself and Don and Bill and a lot of our younger reporters too, but we have a certain level of trust that people know what to expect from us. Now, not everybody loves the media, but I think they know they're going to get a fair shake from us.
So it sounds like the relationship that you have with people, it's something that is strengthened over time and can actually lead to a more valuable outcome.
Yeah, I think that works well for what we're trying to do for people in Maine. I mean, if you think about it, having a television station is a public trust. You're granted the right to use the public airwaves to make money, but you owe something back. And the way that's been paid back traditionally is through public service programming and news. So the fact that we do so many newscasts, and we even have the magazine show 207, which is unique in the state and in a lot of places don't have anything like that. So we have an outlet for Mainers to express themselves, whether it's in a news sense or whether it's in an artistic, or musical, or theatrical sense. There's a place for all of that. And that's really, it's our pleasure to be able to provide that public service, to give something to the people of Maine. And I know you mentioned you talked with Keith Carson. Well, weather is a huge part of that. Whenever you do research and ask people what's important to them, severe weather coverage is number one, because it's Maine, and they want to know what's going on. So that's why we spend so much time finding the right people and making sure they have the tools they need. It's all part of what we owe the public.
I remember WCSH before there was Storm Center. I actually remember when it started, and now you all.
You can't be that old.
I am that old, actually, yes. But I remember how it became like a thing, and I remember at the time I was relatively young, and I was like, really, we have to make this a thing? But over time, it's kind of like got this excitement behind it, like it's Storm Center. We're taking this really seriously.
Yeah, those of us who were working there thought it was a bit much too, and that it occasionally still can seem like overkill from our point of view. But you know, when I was growing up, and maybe you remember part of this too, cancellations were done on the radio. You know, so if it was snowing, you'd get up and you'd turn the radio on to hear if your school was canceled. And that seemed like a radio thing, not a TV thing. But our bosses at the time recognized that, no, we could do this too. Thankfully, we reached the point where we didn't have to read this stuff, that it can all be done with on-screen graphics. And we kind of paved the way for TV stations to do that. Everybody does it now and has for some time, but I really think we were the first ones to break it out and make it a separate thing. And when you hear that music, everybody knows, all right, time to pay attention. And it's actually kind of funny because when the stations were owned by the Thompson family for many years, since the founding back in the 1920s as radio stations. When they were sold to Gannett, which is now Tegna, when corporate ownership took over, they have a little different idea. They want music packages in every market to sound the same. These are the things you can use. But they did give us the exception that we can still use the Storm Center music because we convinced them this is important. This is how we identify this particular part of the newscast.
Which is so true, because I'm actually like replaying it in my mind even now as
yeah,
you're talking.
It's not, and it's an earworm now, and I've cursed you with it.
Yeah, thank you so much for that. You could sing it. Would you like to sing it for
us? I wouldn't,
now?
But you know, we had one of our meteorologists, Cliff Michelson, years ago, was a pretty good fiddle player, and he would play that sometimes on the air on his violin. And Caroline Cornish, I'm sure, could learn it too, so because she plays violin too. And there's nothing like hearing the Storm Center theme on violin, but I can't do that.
Okay, well, maybe you will sneak around like next time the storm comes up,
yeah,
and we'll
yeah.
see if we can catch you unawares or something. We'll see
okay.
if we can get you to do it like in a weak moment. I'm interested in the news these days because I also came from a time I used to deliver both the paper,
mm-hmm.
you know, when there was a Portland Press Herald and there was the Evening Express
right.
and the Maine Sunday Telegram, and this was really how we got our news. It was radio and there was the paper and there was television. And now the news is everywhere, all the time, which is great, and it's been sort of democratized. But I also wonder if there's a lack of curation. There's a lack of, it seems like maybe we don't have the same reflection on what's going on.
Yeah, I think some of that comes from the idea that people can now just, if they choose, listen to something that reflects the point of view they already hold. Something that reinforces what they believe in. And it started with cable channels that skewed one political leaning or another. And it continues with social media through Facebook or Twitter or what have you. And so, you know, your news feed on Facebook sort of is tailored toward the things you're interested in. And there's nothing wrong with that, except really what you need to do is have a broader palette to find information. You know, say if you're someone who's a liberal who only watches MSNBC, you kind of owe it to yourself to spend a couple hours a week watching Fox News just to hear what they're talking about and get some sense, where are they coming from? Why do I disagree with that? And defend your, you know, internally, if you will. But, you know, you can convince yourself, all right, well, maybe I was wrong, or no, I'm more convinced than ever that I was right. But it's true, if you're only getting it through social media, we have a presence there, of course, it's never quite the same as when it's put together in the newspaper or in a newscast. Now, many would disagree because they think the, as you call it, the democratization of it is a good thing in that we don't have to just rely on the so-called mainstream media. But mainstream media, at least the way we do it, is something that we feel you can trust to be fair and reliable, that it's research, that you don't just say something and have it unchecked. Everything is vetted that gets on the air. So there's value in that. And the other problem with social media, and it has hurt a lot of media companies, newspapers in particular, is people have developed an idea that news should be free. And free is nice. But journalists, professional journalists who know how to do this craft, need to be paid or they can't do it. So if you don't subscribe to a newspaper, you're kind of letting down the community in my eyes, that you need to support journalism, even if it's a paper you don't always agree with in their editorial slant. And, you know, people say, well, television is free. So, well, it isn't really. We have commercials. So that's how we pay the bills. And the deal is you sit and watch that half hour and you see the sponsor messages and everybody gets something out of it. So if you're only getting it from social media, and I think you're kind of selling yourself short.
So why do you think we've come to this place where we believe that well-researched, well-written, I don't want to say performed, it's not performed, but well-spoken.
Presented,
yeah. Yes. Information is somehow not worthy of getting support.
I think it might be generational. As younger people have gotten accustomed to using social media for so many things, they don't really see the distinction. And that can be a dangerous thing. If you just believe anything that gets tweeted out without some kind of background check or some kind of verification, you may wind up with some ideas that aren't quite right. That's that whole debate that's going on right now after the presidential election of what's fake news and what isn't. And this idea that facts don't matter is sort of frightening, because facts are facts. And if you quote somebody saying something, you're not somehow attacking them. You're just saying, well, this is what this person has said before. Now they're saying this. Those things don't match up. It's worth pointing that out. But it takes smarter people than I to figure out how you solve that.
I also wonder about the lack of pause, where something is happening, but when something's happening, it's you can't necessarily make a good judgment. You can't necessarily get the background on it. You can't know what the long-term implications. And so if you put the news out there as it's happening, and that becomes the report of it.
Without perspective,
exactly.
Well, it is, and that's been changing for a long time. And it used to be, back in the 60s, for example, you had one newscast in the evening. You had a 6 and then 11 o'clock. So the reporters working on the 6 o'clock news had all day to gather their information, call sources, check out what they had, and put the story together in a thoughtful way. Then you would start adding more newscasts. The deadlines start coming earlier. They come at 5:30, and then they come at 5 o'clock. Now deadlines are constant. You're supposed to be posting to the web or social media right away. When you're covering a story, they want you putting out photos or maybe little videos as it's happening. And again, the immediacy is good. It gets people interested in the story. But as you point out, if it's done without much consideration of the bigger picture or what it all really means, I'm not sure any of us gain from that. However, that's technology, and it's brought us to this point today, and we have to learn to make the best of it and be careful not to rush to just to try to be first, to try to be right first. So when the TV producer Grant Tinker died last week, in his obituary, they talked about one of his mottos when he started running NBC in their entertainment division was, first be best, then be number one, or then be first. So that can apply to us as well. You've got to remind yourself, and I have to remind myself too, well, I've failed at this as well. There are times when you rush to get something out first and it's not quite right or not what you believed it was or just flat out wrong. And when it does, then you apologize and you try to fix it and you move on. And that's at least one thing that the so-called mainstream media does that perhaps others, the fake news, will not do. is that if we get it wrong, we'll admit we got it wrong, and we'll try to make it right as fast as we can. And sometimes others will not do that.
You are one of the few reporters in the country on air live from the Kennedy Space Center when the Space Shuttle Challenger was destroyed. Now, I remember this. I was in geometry class in high school, and it was a big deal back then. But I wasn't there. I just heard about it from my teacher, who was devastated. I suspect we all know where we were at that time.
Yeah.
You were there, though.
I was. Yeah, it's interesting how that came about, too, because we, in Framingham, where I grew up, I knew the Corrigan family. They went to the same church we did, and so our families, I didn't know them well, but I knew them enough, and my dad was friends with Krista McAuliffe's dad. Her maiden name was Corrigan. So we, I kind of had that little bit of an advantage when I told the news director at the time, when she was chosen, Krista McAuliffe, the teacher from Concord, New Hampshire, chosen to be the first teacher in space. I said, gee, I really think we should cover this live. It's local enough. New Hampshire is right there. And I might have oversold the connection that I had to the family, but not by much. I said, oh, yeah, this is going to be a great story. And he bought into it and said, yeah, we should go cover that. And the launch was delayed several times for various technical reasons. It was also very cold there. In fact, some of the Florida reporters blamed those of us coming from New England for bringing the cold with us. We really weren't prepared for that. We're, you know, hadn't brought winter gear or anything. You'd go to a Sears down there and try to buy some winter gloves. They don't have them, you know. So we, while we were covering the launch, there was a press grandstand, and there was a VIP grandstand. And so the photographer I was with was down by the VIP section shooting video. There was, in the Teacher in Space program, if you recall, there were two teachers chosen from every state to be the finalists. And one of the teachers from Maine was making the trip to watch the launch, a guy named Gordon Corbett from Yarmouth.
Who was also my teacher.
Oh, well, there you go. So then you know exactly what I'm talking about. So Gordon was there. And as part of the story, we wanted to see his reaction to the flight. And we were, everyone, of course, expecting it's going to be jubilant. It's going to be great. So this was the big payoff at last. And so when the launch happened and when the explosion happened, for those of us who'd never seen one of these things in person, it looked wrong. But you figure, well, maybe that's what it looks like in person. I don't know. And then when it got so quiet, you weren't hearing the chatter on the radio anymore. It suddenly, okay, there's really a problem here. And what your hope was that we'd seen all the briefings about ways they could have a return to launch site abort. You know, if something was going wrong, they could separate the orbiter and land. And you're hoping, well, gee, we hope that's what it is. But I was sitting near another reporter, a guy from Florida Today newspaper, who actually lives in Maine again. His name is Chet Lunner. And he said, I could see, I was sitting right next to him, and he said, no, this is bad. This is, you know, and because we're on the air live, I was actually on the phone. We were showing the pictures from the NASA Select satellite, but I was on a telephone, and we had Patsy Wiggins in the studio sort of anchoring the coverage. You had to be careful not to say what you didn't know. You needed to say something, but you can't say, oh, crap, they're going to be dead, because you didn't know that. But in the back of your mind, you figure, you know, it doesn't seem, everything we've heard about what this really means is there is no real escape from this. And so you start calling on your background knowledge. And this is where homework comes in. So that I knew a lot about the space program, of course, having grown up while it was the big moonshot race and everything. And I remembered Apollo 13. This was before the movie was made or anything, but I remembered all of that. I was able to talk a little bit about, well, there have been accidents before, and they've been able to improvise and survive it. And you end up filling time. We were on the air off and on. NBC hadn't cut in yet because they weren't covering it live. The space shuttle program had gotten so routine, the networks weren't covering it. I think CNN was because that was their job. And the station in Manchester was because it was a New Hampshire story. I think Channel 13 might have been as well because they had a reporter there. Anyway, so we had to fill all this time. And it was hard because I never saw the video of the explosion at the time, until that night. I saw what happened before my eyes. But it wasn't until that night when I finally saw the videotape and I said, my God, it's so obvious what just happened, you know, because it's the picture is so close. But at that moment, let's say you rely on the homework you've done and the background that you have, and you can speak extemporaneously about it. And you have to keep your emotions in check because nobody wants to hear you falling apart because it was shocking and sad and, you know, so unexpected. And so you don't really think about that till you're done with the job for the day. And that carries through into anything you cover, really. There are times when the news is so tragically sad. You know, little kids with cancer or whatever it is. And, you know, you can't get so wrapped up in it that you're falling apart. Really, people are looking for someone to, you know, tell us about it and, you know, kind of keep a cool head. So that's what I try to do.
Well, I think about the work that I do in my other job as a doctor and some of the stories that I hear and what people are needing from me. And it's kind of similar. Like, mm-hmm. you know, you're thinking to yourself, oh my God, I personally feel so devastated by what is going on. But that's not who I'm supposed to be right now.
Yeah.
I'm not supposed to be Lisa the person. I'm supposed to be Dr. Belial the doctor. But I still have to do what you're talking about. I still have to go home at the end of the day and process through this stuff. And it still has an impact on me, even after years and years of doing this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's true. Excuse me. You know, because something like that in particular, that's such a massive worldwide tragedy, and that fits the actual word. The word tragedy tends to get thrown around a lot, but I thought that fit. And you have to, you know, you have to process that and not get so wrapped up in it. Now, I remember it wasn't until about a year later that I kind of felt I understood it, or, you know, could understand why I felt the way I did when we did the first anniversary stuff. And over the years, we revisited the story on anniversaries. And I remember the last time I saw Krista McAuliffe's mom, we went down to Framingham to talk to her, and she'd written a book. And, you know, I thought she handled it with so much grace. I happen to be her name as well, but it really suited her. I just thought, you know, if she can deal with this, well, I can. You know, I don't need to feel sad about it every January 28th. It doesn't mean you forget it, but, you know, you can. These things happen. Bad things happen sometimes to people who don't deserve it. And you learn what you can from it, and you move on. So that's, you know, I think there is a similarity.
What are some of the things that you've covered that have surprised you?
Well, just most recently, the political world has surprised us. I remember in 2010, when Paul LePage was first running for governor, the first time I interviewed him, he was very little known. He was the mayor of Waterville, but there were several other Republicans running for the nomination that year who had more money and more higher profile, people like Les Otten and Steve Abbott and so on. And you figure, well, one of these guys is going to get the nomination. But when I sat down with Paul LePage and listened to some of his ideas, I thought, and he was such a down-to-earth guy, I thought to myself, if this guy could get any money, he could really do well here. I mean, I think people will relate to him. And, well, lo and behold, comes primary night, and he had a good organization, not so much money, I think, but enough people that believed in his cause that got out the vote, and in a primary, that's the most important thing, that he did win that nomination. I remember that primary night, he looked as surprised as anybody else, I think he was, that it worked out that way for him. And then when he won the general election, it was a lesson that, you know, in not accepting the conventional wisdom. And that came into play again this year with Donald Trump, because I'll admit, I'm not in the predictions business, it's not what I do. But I said, like so many people a year and a half ago, there's not a chance. This guy's not serious. He's just doing it for publicity. Voters will never buy into this. They're interested in him because he's a celebrity, so they're going to go to his rallies. But, well, we were completely wrong. You know, I think a lot of people felt that way. So that's when I say you think you've seen it all, but you really haven't. And so it's a good wake-up call to remind yourself, don't just follow the conventional wisdom. Don't just listen to the political talking head class, that there's more going on out there. There's real people behind all this who want something different. And you have to do a better job of figuring out what that is, who they are.
Did the news industry feel blindsided?
I think in a way, in general, the news industry did, especially those, you know, on the national level that spend so much time covering these things. They have their own crews following the candidates around, and they have all the experts, the former political office holders. And we do political analysis on Maine stuff, too. We have a couple of former legislators who do stuff with us. And they're pretty well plugged into what goes on in the state. But everybody, I think, missed the idea that this was something new. This was something, the things that would have sunk any other candidate from the very beginning when Donald Trump criticized John McCain. You know, you don't go after veterans, war heroes, that doesn't work, you'll be finished. None of that stuff hurt him at all. And it was because people liked something about his message more than they cared about specifics like that. They were mad at Washington in general, mad at the establishment that they felt had let them down and left them behind. So if you're only listening to people who are part of that establishment, as tends to happen, yeah, you get blindsided because you're not hearing the right message, nor are they. You know, they're going on the air, the cable talking heads. They're going on the air without having been anywhere. Too many of them haven't talked to real voters. They've only talked to each other. That's another hard lesson to take out of this, that we can all do better.
You've been doing this long enough so that you know the things that kind of feel good about the job that you do. Is there anything that has evolved over time that you've come to realize about yourself and your particular fit with the job that you do? Anything that has taken a few years to realize, wow, this works for me. I like this, and this is one of the reasons I want to stay here doing this.
Yeah, well, I mean, as for staying here and doing this, I always joke that it's better than working for a living. But in a way, it is. Of course, as I mentioned before, there's the mundane parts of any job. But you meet so many interesting people, and the longer you're here, the more people are willing, I think, to trust you and open up to you. And Maine is a big, small town. We're fortunate in that with only, 1.3 million people, you can know a lot of the people that live here. If you don't know them individually, then you know people in their community, and you get to learn something about different ways of life. And in Maine, there are many different ways of life. So I think that's rewarding about it, and it comes back to you as you, people recognize you're part of the community too. You're not just somebody who's on TV, and they recognize you for that. And there's people who want to say hello because they recognize you, which is great. I mean, it's awfully nice, but it really is partly because they feel like they know you, because they do. You are part of the community, and so that's part of what keeps you doing it.
You're a Beatles fan.
Yes.
And from what I've
got my Rubber Soul shirt on.
I love it. I bet you don't get to wear this very often.
No, I could wear it under my suit coat, I suppose, but I'm not dressed for the job right now. I'm dressed for radio.
Well, that works for me. I know that you and our audio producer Spencer actually kind of bonded over the Beatles.
Indeed, we did, and I feel like I've been a little helpful to him as one of the younger second or third generation fans. I was there at the beginning, so I can offer him some insight on what's important.
That's true.
And this is one of your early loves, was music, when you were back working as a college DJ.
Yeah. I mean, in fact, I always wished, more than being in television news, I wished I could be a DJ, do top 40 radio or FM kind of radio. And I would have, except for two things. One, you don't really get to choose the music when you're doing it commercially. You don't get to pick everything. Second, you really don't make much money. You got to make a living. So that didn't happen. But I always would have loved to have done it as a sideline, just for fun, because it's something I've always enjoyed. You find things that work together musically, and when you're growing up, everybody has the music of their era. I think the music you love when you're 14 is what you're going to love the rest of your life, probably. You really, because you're listening so intensely. You got the radio on all the time, and when you're playing records, you sit and you listen to them. They're not just on in the background. You're thinking about it, so you connect with that. If it's something you love, you will for the rest of your life, and so I do.
Do you ever think of yourself as being an important part of people's daily lives? Do you ever think of yourself as, I'm sitting down to dinner with people, and I'm one of the last things they see before they go to sleep? Or
that sort of thing occurs to you when you meet them, and they'll tell you. Like we just recently did the annual Coats for Kids drive, so we all go out to various locations, the supermarkets where we collect the coats and the toys. And so that's a chance to meet a lot of people. They know you're going to be there, so they come by and you chat with them. And so we watch you all the time. You know, we've been seeing you for so many years. That's when you think about it. If you spent every day walking around thinking about that, it would be pretty ridiculous. You know, you'd get a big head for no reason. And when I introduce myself to people, they sometimes will say, "Oh, well, you know who you are." I says, "Well, I assume nothing. You know, take nothing for granted, because not everybody does." And you kind of have to look at it that way. If you've walked around all the time thinking how important you are, that's not a good way to live your life.
Well, I appreciate your taking the time to switch back to your radio presence, to your radio persona, and coming in and having a conversation with me today. I've been speaking with Pat Callahan, who started working at WCSH 6 News Center in December 1979. And certainly your station has been a part of my growing up in the state of Maine, so I thank you for all the work that you do, and I appreciate your being here.
I thank you and everybody else for caring and keeping us employed.